Don't let her son find these. They're not for Eric. 12 weeks earlier, Holly Cottage, Great Houghton, Northampton. They'd never met in person, but Mrs. Baker's housekeeper, Maria, recognised Eric from old family photographs, now locked in a chest in her deceased employer's attic. Maria had expected someone to arrive at the cottage after Mr. Baker passed away, but she hadn't expected it to be Mrs. Baker's son. "Hello, my name's Nicole Granger, and this is my friend," the girl began. She was as pretty as Mrs. Baker had described her when Maria visited her in hospital, but she clamped her mouth shut and tried to hide her uneasiness at the sight of Eric. He had not been part of the plan. "I know why you are here," Maria interrupted, and went back into the house, leaving the front door open. She guessed Nicole and Eric were probably looking at each other, unsure of what to say, when they followed her into Mrs. Baker's lounge. "Wait here," she ordered, and left the room. Maria closed the kitchen door behind her, and, uncharacteristically, began to panic. She'd last seen Mrs. Baker a few days before her death, when she'd told Maria of her plan to change a young nurse's life. With Maria well provided for and bequeathed the cottage, Mrs. Baker desperately wanted Nicole to experience the world, so she dictated a letter, which Maria wrote. The diamonds were already in the truck's air vent, as instructed, and on the passenger seat was a box with enough money to get the truck up and running and exported to America. Nicole was then to pick it up at a dock in Chicago, the city that was the starting point of Route 66. In the event that Nicole failed to discover the diamonds, Mrs. Baker told Maria that at least her protégé would have had the trip of a lifetime if she followed a vague map, her cryptic note, and could recall their conversations together. But Maria knew the last thing Mrs. Baker would have expected, or wanted, was for the boy she once described as a wolf in wolf's clothing to have benefited from them. So Maria needed a plan B. She darted around the kitchen, silently opening and closing drawers until she found a notepaper and pen. She hurriedly scribbled the words, "Don't let her son find these, they're not for Eric," and poked it into the air vent before regaining her poise and showing her visitors the pickup truck. Then she clasped her hands, entwined her fingers, and hoped for the best. Today. The note tore Nicole apart like a bird hitting a propeller. She was familiar with the expression, blood running cold, but had never experienced it until that moment. It didn't make sense, she thought. How on earth could her best friend of 2 years be the son of Mrs. Baker? Why wouldn't he have mentioned such a crucial piece of information while his mother was dying, in a room next to him, or as he and Nicole planned their trip? Why had he never visited her? He'd had every opportunity to do so. So there could only be one probable reason for his silence. He was using his friendship with Nicole to find his inheritance. Nicole's mind continued to race, still trying to find alternative meanings in the scribbled note. But there were none. It was what it was, and gradually memories of the last couple of months began to fit together like pieces in a jigsaw. Eric's recent criticism of a woman he never knew, his eagerness to take a 2-month unpaid sabbatical from work and accompany Nicole, and then his fury when they reached Buffalo Springs Lake. "Eric, you can't be," she said out loud. "I can't be what?" came a voice in her ear, making her yelp. "What's with you?" laughed Eric. "Nothing, nothing," Nicole replied. The rapid speed of her pulse made her body judder. Her fist clenched the velvet pouch, and its contents dug sharply into her hand. "What happened to the vent?" he asked, noticing the plastic casing lying in the footwell.
I was picking at it," Nicole stumbled, and slowly slid the pouch from her hand and into her pocket.
Then she picked up the casing and jammed it back in place.
"Can we go?"
Eric returned to the driver's seat, put his seatbelt on and pulled away, ready to return to Venice Beach. As Nicole tried to regulate her breathing,
She was unaware the breeze coming through the windows had blown Maria's note under her seat. Chapter 17. Some 3,000 regulars made their way to downtown Santa Monica's farmers market each and every Sunday. Unlike other markets throughout the city, Santa Monica's appealed to more than single shoppers, or restaurant staff picking up the freshest local produce for their eateries. It targeted young and old with food stalls, arts and crafts stands, face painting and pony rides.
"This looks just ripe enough," said Jane, picking up a grapefruit and squeezing it. "Should have a good week left in it."
"How do you know this stuff?" asked Savannah, who, back in Alabama, never had called to set foot inside a supermarket, let alone a street crammed with colourful edibles.
"When you're a mum, they give you a manual for this kind of thing."
When a confused Savannah frowned, Jane added,
"I'm kidding, darling."
"How many kids do you have?"
"Oh, I have two," she replied casually. "Well, I had two, but they passed away." It still never sounds like it's me when I'm saying that.
"Oh, God, I'm sorry," gasped Savannah.
"That's okay. And speaking of children, when are you due?"
Chapter 18. There were almost 130 people from 28 different nationalities sleeping under the roof of the Venice Beach International Hostel. But Tommy still instantly recognized the figure walking along the corridor ahead of him. Even with the back of his head obscured, the olive-green frayed backpack was a giveaway, decorated with dozens of airport security tags, flight labels, Greyhound and Amtrak tickets, and stickers hung from straps and zips, a tapestry of wanderlust that could only belong to Jake. Tommy felt a sudden sense of dismay when he realized that Jake had packed up to leave. He'd already lost one ally in Nicole that week, but that friendship was only ever going to be temporary, and Tommy felt that he and Jake still had some way to go. Meanwhile, as Jake made his way towards the hostel's front door, he was still embarrassed and angry with himself for letting his guard down and befriending Tommy, even though he hadn't revealed anything about his past life as Stuart Reynolds, pop star. He'd allowed Tommy to get closer than most. Jake hadn't planned to kiss him, and he knew Tommy was straight, but he'd let his emotions get the better of him and acted on impulse, not forethought. Jake was attracted to Tommy, he could admit that to himself now, and like any gay man who'd ever had a crush on a straight guy, he knew nothing would come of it. So to stop himself making more of a fool of himself than he already had, he reasoned it was better to just disappear.
"I thought you only left when people weren't looking," yelled Tommy.
"Oh, hi." "Yeah," Jake replied, turning around and clearly flustered.
"So?"
"So, what?"
"So you can't leave, 'cause I'm looking."
"I made a bit of a tit of myself, so I thought it best I just go."
"Oh, you mean after you tried to snog my face off?"
Tommy teased. "I was a bit emotional. I was thinking about home and, well, I dealt with it the wrong way, I'm sorry."
"You said being homesick was the sacrifice you make for a fresh start."
"Using my own words against me, eh? Maybe I'm not as sorted as you think I am."
"Maybe you're just more human than you realize."
"Possibly," thought Jake. "Or maybe I've just made more fucking stupid decisions than you'll ever know." 2 years earlier, London. The tinted windows of the limousine couldn't completely hide the camera flashes as Stuart and soap actress Katie Begley pulled away from the red carpet film premiere and drove towards London's embankment. Even though the clock was approaching midnight, the roads were overcrowded, and they moved slowly as the audience dispersed towards their vehicles and public transport. A familiar, frosty silence between Katie and Stuart filled the limo. As it often did when they were left alone, theirs was a relationship of convenience, dreamed up by managers and PR experts eager to promote both their brands. In front of the cameras, they were love's young dream. But away from the flashing lights of the paparazzi, they had little in common, and even less of a desire to discover common ground in their manufactured worlds. Katie tucked her strawberry blonde hair behind her ear, put her fingers down her blouse, and pulled out 5 finger-sized paper wraps from her bra. She expertly tapped out a powdery substance from one of them onto her clutch bag, placed the wraps on it, and carefully shaped 4 lines with her VIP lanyard.
"Haven't you done enough for that already?" Stuart asked. "You took enough toilet breaks during the film to snort half of Columbia."
Katie ignored him, then removed a straw from her purse, placed it at the base of her nostril, and snorted 2 lines in quick succession, finishing with a long, hard blink as the cocaine numbed the back of her throat.
"Do you want some?"
she asked Stuart, pointing to the remaining lines.
"No, I'm good,"
he replied, eager to leave her side and reach their destination. Aside from the occasional joint, drugs weren't a high priority for Stuart. His social workers had informed him that his parents' substance addiction was the reason he'd been removed from them as a toddler and placed into care. He'd since learned his mother had died of a heroin overdose some years later, and he couldn't bear to read the self-pitying story his father had sold to the Sunday Mirror about how much he missed his only son, a son he hadn't bothered to track down until fame came his way. Stuart had dabbled with speed and cocaine recreationally with the rest of Lightning Strikes, and kept a small stash in his apartment for when Zack was in town. Most of the time Stuart only indulged in stimulants with Zack, and that was only to enhance the sex.
"Fucking on coke is like nothing else,"
Zack had told him the first night they spent together. And he wasn't wrong.
"Suit yourself," said Katie, wiping her top lip with a tissue. "Not much fun, are you? Don't know why I keep agreeing to this." "Because being seen with me makes you front-page news," Stuart sniped. "Without me, you're relegated to TV guides."
"Well, Jerry, better not screw me over."
"Neither of us is getting screwed the rate this traffic's moving.
Driver, how much longer do you reckon it's going to take?"
As the glass partition descended, Katie passed Stuart her handbag with the 2 remaining lines of coke scattered across it.
Hold this for a minute," she said.
Her voice wobbled as she accidentally knocked the other wraps into his lap.
"Be careful,"
Stuart snapped. But as he gave Katie an angry stare, her eyes rolled back into her head and her body went into seizure.
"We're just pulling in now, sir,"
the driver replied as the car moved towards the hotel entrance. A panicked Stuart knew by heart the well-rehearsed routine that was supposed to follow. But that night would be different, because before he had time to prevent it from happening, one of the hotel staff opened his limo door, and 6 cameras snapped the star of Britain's biggest boy band, with 2 lines of cocaine balanced on his lap, 3 wraps of it in his hand, and a convulsing teenage actress by his side. Today, Hostel.
"I'm not gay, just for the record,"
Tommy told Jake firmly.
"I mean, it doesn't bother me that you are, but I'm not. I just wanted to clear that up."
I know, Jake replied, and hitched his rucksack further up towards his shoulders. "I've booked into a hostel in West Hollywood. Maybe we could catch up in a few days."
"You don't have to go. Nobody needs to know you're gay if you'd prefer to keep it quiet. Not that I think anyone here would give a shit, but you can trust me,"
Tommy replied. "People can't let you down if you don't trust them."
"Another pearl of wisdom, eh?"
Suddenly Tommy grabbed Jake by the cheeks and kissed him. Not just a peck on the lips, but a proper kiss.
"There!"
Tommy laughed, a little surprised by his own spontaneity.
"We're equal now, so let's put your rucksack back in your room and go get a Chinese."
As the 2 headed back towards Jake's room, neither noticed a camera phone pointing in their direction. Chapter 19.
"How do you know I'm pregnant?"
a startled Savannah asked Jane.
Jane put down the punnet of strawberries she was holding at the market stall and took both of Savannah's hands.
"Sweetheart, you're in a hurry to make money in a job that doesn't match your education. Your arms aren't marked and your pupils aren't dilated, so you're not spending any on drugs. I don't see any Jimmy Choos under your bed, so you're not wasting your money on fashion. So, what are you doing with it? Probably saving it. And what for? An end game of sorts. Now, it could be to move out of the hostel and to get your own apartment, but something tells me there's more to you than meets the eye, and that you're doing this job, working these crazy hours and putting yourself in harm's way, because you know you can't do it for much longer. So why could that be? Because you're expecting a baby.
Savannah was taken aback.
You got all that from sharing a room with me for a day?
Jane grinned.
Now I got all that from the positive pregnancy testing kit you left in the bathroom bin.
Savannah laughed for the first time that day.
I do one every 2 or 3 weeks, just to make sure,
she admitted.
I know. It's crazy, considering I'm almost 5 months gone. Well, you're lucky you're not showing yet, and you're keeping the baby when it arrives. Yes, I'm saving for a deposit on an apartment, and Paik lets me stay at the hostel for free. I'm sure I'll start getting bigger soon. There's not much demand for strippers with stretch marks. I don't know. There seems to be a fetish for just about anything these days.
Jane picked up her strawberries, handed them to the stallholder and removed her purse from her handbag.
You need to keep up your vitamin C intake. We'll get you some Setsumas and iron supplements before we go home.
Savannah was puzzled by Jane's interest in her. Paik and Tommy aside, it felt like a very long time since someone had offered her kindness. But she couldn't help but feel suspicious.
That's about your age when I got pregnant with my first.
Jane continued.
I spent 9 months peeing every half hour or vomiting. I've only had morning sickness a handful of times. You're lucky. Your parents supporting you? No,
said Savannah quietly. We don't really have a relationship.
That's a shame. You could really do with their help at a time like this.
Do you mind me asking what happened to your kids?
Savannah continued, changing the subject.
Not at all. My friends get this awkward look about them when I bring them up, so I don't get to talk about them much.
Jane paused and chose her words carefully before speaking.
My husband killed our children.
Chapter 20 Day 10
Can I ask what you're doing here, ma'am?
Zach aside, the private security staff who pulled up outside his address were the first people to speak to Ruth during her week-long Hollywood Hills sojourn.
I'm waiting for a friend,
Ruth replied and gave the officers a courteous smile.
Who exactly is your friend, ma'am?
Zach Stanley. He lives here.
We're aware of that. And does Mr. Stanley know you're camped outside his home?
Oh, yeah. We've spoken a bunch of times. And every now and again the camera looks right at me so I can give him a wave.
The guards looked at each other, thinking the same thing. She was a nut job, but a harmless one.
Well, ma'am, although this isn't a private road, we do have the authority to ask you to move on if Mr. Stanley makes another complaint.
Oh, he won't, don't worry,
said Ruth, trying to convince herself that despite their last fractious meeting, there was still hope for a relationship of sorts.
We're friends.
Ruth had already made the decision before the guard's arrival that until Zach returned and they'd had the chance to talk properly, she couldn't risk leaving her seat outside his house to go back to the hostel. So she'd spent a second evening catnapping on the sidewalk, waking each time a car drove past or she heard a voice, and vacating her spot to traipse down the hill to stock up on sugary snacks at the convenience store, or to wash in its customer restroom. Food was a necessity, but buying deodorant, a toothbrush, or even cheap clothing hadn't crossed Ruth's mind, because the longer she spent away from the house, the more risk there was of missing Zach's return. And as the security men left and the hours rolled by, Ruth became more and more anxious about why she hadn't seen him in almost 24 hours.
Chapter 21 Nicole took
quiet, deep breaths, in a desperate attempt to ward off a panic attack. She'd not suffered one in more than a decade, but she recognized the warning signs of hot flushes, trembling arms, and nausea. She knew she must control her body as best she could, so as not to give Eric any idea everything between them had changed. Eric drove without a break for the 300-mile leg of their journey on the 110 West, passing through New Mexico and Arizona, and then crossing into California. And for most of it, Nicole's head was turned towards the window as she stared at the desert landscape, illuminated by an almost full moon. Her heart hadn't stopped racing since she had discovered Maria's note, and her hand remained inside her pocket, containing Mrs. Baker's diamonds. There had been casual and polite chit-chat between her and Eric, but during the many silences, her thoughts were dominated by what to do once they returned to the hostel. And time again she asked herself how she'd failed to realize Eric's real identity. The answer was always the same. There had been no reason to doubt him. Eric once revealed his father had died when he was a child, and that his mother had struggled to cope, so she'd packed him off to boarding school. The years had estranged them further, and he'd even changed his surname to distance himself from his family. Nicole believed he'd also failed to mention his presence to his mother at the hospital, even though he'd spent the best part of a week just feet away from her. Several times Nicole had asked if he wanted to meet Mrs. Baker, but each time he declined, claiming he was too busy. A perfectly plausible excuse on an understaffed ward. And just days earlier, Eric had even helped to scatter his mother's ashes, without so much as shedding a tear. Their 2-year friendship, during which Nicole had bared her soul to him, had become rotten. What scared her the most was where to go from here. Inside her pocket lay a potential fortune, and sitting next to her was a man who'd lied through his teeth to get hold of it. What else might he be capable of? Nicole desperately needed to talk her options through with someone, and an ocean away from home there was only one person she trusted enough to turn to for advice. Tommy. After their latest failed mission in Lubbock, it didn't take much for Nicole to persuade him returning to Venice Beach would be a good thing for the both of them. They could relax in somewhere familiar and plan for their return to London. "Shall we put some music on?" asked Eric suddenly, stretching out his hand to turn the radio on. He flicked around the dial until he found a station and chirped along to the chorus of a 30-year-old Fleetwood Mac song. "Tell me lies, tell me sweet little lies," he sang, both of them aware of the irony of the lyrics, but neither mentioning it. Chapter 22.
"You'd like me to tell you what happened to my babies, wouldn't you?"
Jane guessed that after dropping the bombshell the previous day about the death of her children at their father's hands, Savannah might be curious as to the circumstances, but wasn't sure how to ask. After their shopping expedition to the farmer's market, they'd discussed many topics, but nothing about the events that had altered Jane's life for good. And as Savannah had revealed very little about her father, or why she'd escaped his grip, she knew that disclosure was a two-way street, so she had no right to ask. But if Jane wanted to offer a further explanation, Savannah would be more than happy to listen. They were at the kitchen sink rinsing punnets of fruit under a tap when Jane stopped and rummaged around her handbag, removing a plastic wallet. She opened it to reveal a portable photo frame with space for 2 pictures, a pair of smiling young faces with brightly coloured ice cream covering their lips, beamed from behind a protective film, frozen in time.
"That's Gregory," Jane began,
pointing to a boy of no more than 5 with bright red hair and freckles.
"And that's Ruby. She's 7.
"She was 7. Her voice trailed off. Ruby shared her brother's features, and her auburn curls cascaded across her shoulders.
"They're beautiful,"
Savannah replied, saddened that the 2 innocent souls she was staring at were no more.
"Peter, my husband, was a very controlling, very violent man,"
Jane explained. And I reached the point where I couldn't take any more. Our relationship, if you could call it that, didn't equip us to raise a family. So when I told him I was planning to leave with the children, it was like I'd pushed a detonator, and he exploded. He beat me unconscious, and I don't remember much else, only waking up on the lounge floor to find the house on fire. I tried to get upstairs to the kids' bedrooms, but the heat was too intense. So I ran to a neighbour's house for help, and they called 999. We returned with a ladder, but by then, well, it was too late. All three of them were gone.
Savannah swallowed hard, understanding all too well the damage a domineering patriarch can cause.
"Oh, Jane, that's awful."
Jane offered a grateful half-smile, but she couldn't hold it for long.
"The man I married wasn't always bad," she continued. "I know there was some good left in him somewhere. That's why I stayed for so long, because I wanted him to go back to being the man I fell in love with. At least that's what I tell myself, because I don't think I can bear the alternative. But I could have prevented this from happening by leaving years earlier and keeping my baby safe."
"You can't blame yourself," said Savannah, and placed her arm around Jane's shoulder.
"Is that why you came to America? To get away from what happened?"
"Yes, and because my life had no purpose anymore. I wanted to do the things my kids will never have the chance to do. So I decided to see the world for them. It's a bit silly, isn't it? A woman of my age chasing a dream two kids were too young to have."
"No, it's not. Sometimes we have no choice but to leave our old lives just to keep going."
"Yes, yes, I get that,"
nodded Jane.
"But how long can you run for?"
Savannah had often wondered the same thing.
"What about you? You haven't mentioned anything about your baby's father. Is he still around?"
"Huh?" Savannah replied. "If I was to believe one of my father's sermons, I'd say it was an immaculate conception. But the truth is, I was raped."
"Oh, darling,"
said Jane, a look of sympathy quickly spreading across her face.
"It's okay. Well, it's not okay, obviously. But it could have been worse, because I don't remember anything about it. Someone slipped a roofie in my drink. Then 5 weeks and one missed period later, I find out I'm pregnant."
Jane shook her head.
"The bastard.
I could either let it kill me, or it can make me stronger. So I'm settling for the latter option, but sometimes I find myself walking down the boardwalk, and I see a cute guy who smiles at me, and I wonder, was that you? Were you the one who did that to me? And I can beat myself up about it, you know, never knowing who it is. Or I can focus on trying to make the best life possible for my baby. So that's what I'm going to do." From the corridor, Paige quietly listened to Jane and Savannah's heart-to-heart, and watched as Jane put her arm around Savannah and tilted her head towards her shoulder. And he realized the night he first met Savannah, he'd made a serious error of judgment. Chapter 23.
"What the fuck?"
The image greeting Tommy and Jake as they turned the corner stopped them both in their tracks. It was an A3-sized poster, taped to the landing wall, of Tommy and Jake's kiss. It had been blown up, printed, and then mounted for all to see. Tommy stared at it in dismay before Jake tore it down.
"People are going to think,"
began Tommy.
"It was only a bit of fun."
"I know," Jake interrupted. "I'm really sorry, but look, it's gone now. Let's throw it away and forget about it." As they walked towards the kitchen bin, both were aghast to see every wall plastered in more posters of their kiss. Jake frantically began to rip them down by the handful. The low profile he'd worked so hard to keep was unraveling. 2 years earlier, London. Stuart paced around his apartment for much of the night, working out his options. and devising explanations and excuses for being caught with a convulsing teen soap star and lines of cocaine on his lap. As soon as the limousine's door had opened and the cameras started snapping, in a blind panic he'd shoved the remaining wraps of cocaine into his pocket and pushed Katie's clutch bag to the footwell, showering them both in a cloud of white paper. Stuart had left Katie to face the consequences of her actions alone, while he fought his way through the paparazzi, elbowing one in the nose and knocking another to the pavement as he darted towards the hotel lobby. Once inside the fancy Cardinian building, guests and staff turned their heads to stare at the commotion outside, and all eyes fell on a clearly agitated Stuart as he hurried towards the elevators. He pressed the button for the 23rd floor, where Zack always camped out when in town, and glanced at his reflection in the copper-coloured metal doors. He could feel himself sweating as he tried not to dwell on how social media and the press were about to have a field day with what their lenses had just captured. Stuart was desperate to see Zack because Zack would know what to do. As a child star, he'd grown up in the public eye and could count on the best Hollywood PR machine money could buy to cover any indiscretions. Stuart thought back to how he and Zack had first met, a year earlier in the green room of a Dutch TV chat show, Zack promoting his latest movie, and Stuart and the band performing their new single in an attempt to crack the European music market. They'd chatted politely, but the unspoken spark between them was impossible to ignore. And when they met up again later that night in the bar of their shared hotel, their dangerous liaison began. Geography and grueling work schedules meant their time together was often brief and always kept under the radar, away from prying eyes. And the covert nature of their relationship suited them just fine because, as their working lives were spent as public property, both appreciated having something that was theirs alone. As the lift approached the ground floor, a thought suddenly struck Stuart, with a new type of press attention suddenly thrust upon him. Would it be such a wise move for him to see Zack that night? When Stuart lived just a few miles away in Canary Wharf, why would he be staying in a hotel? He'd abandoned Katie in the car, having convinced himself her seizure had been a brief but minor incident, and that if she'd had any sense, which was debatable, she'd have come around and told the driver to get the hell out of there. If reporters did a little digging, it would only take a small amount of financial encouragement for an indiscreet member of staff to reveal Zack Stanley was also a hotel guest, thus allowing them to put two and two together. Granted, it was a long shot, but it wasn't a risk worth taking. So Stuart made a snap decision to leave the hotel and hurried towards a rear fire exit he'd snuck out of after a past tryst with Zack. With no battery power left in his mobile phone, he was forced to wait until the taxi dropped him off at his apartment block before he could call Zack from his landline. But it went straight to voicemail. Stuart paced around his flat, took a deep breath and logged on to the Daily Mail's website from his iPad. 90 minutes after being caught white-handed, there at the top of the page and also in the infamous sidebar of shame, was his photograph in all its glory. A wide-eyed Stuart Reynolds, with two lines of cocaine on his teenage actress girlfriend's handbag. There was also a link to a video of the incident, but as soon as Stuart saw the headline, he knew things were worse than he'd feared. It read, "Soap actress, critically ill after drugs binge with pop star boyfriend. She has seizure while he runs." Shit, thought Stuart, realizing that in a no-win situation he'd only made matters worse by leaving a poorly Katie alone. The media and fans wouldn't care if they were her drugs and that she'd done it to herself. He would be the scapegoat. Stuart knew he shouldn't, but he switched to his Twitter app and keyed in his name. But he couldn't keep up with the number of threads that mentioned him, many reposting the Mail's pictures. The UK was alight with a new celebrity scandal, and Stuart was in the eye of the storm. He was relieved lightning strikes had yet to conquer America, and immediately decided that's where he would set up camp until the furore blew over. Stuart's charging phone suddenly burst to life and vibrated the first of dozens of missed telephone call alerts. They were mainly from numbers he didn't recognize, but he speculated they belonged to reporters looking for exclusives. He'd also received voicemail messages from other members of the band. Tentatively, he listened to them and grimaced as the words "fucking idiot" and "ruined it for us all" were thrown about. With Zack still on his mind, Stuart called him again, but this time a woman answered.
"I'm sorry, but he's still at the premiere party,"
began Mimi, Zack's sister and personal assistant. But Stuart knew she was lying because Zack loathed those parties and only ever stayed for 10 minutes to network with the big players in the industry before slipping out.
"I'll tell him you called," she added,
and hung up. "He knows what's happened," thought Stuart. "He knows." There was only one person who could sort this mess out. His manager, Jerry Garland. So Stuart braced himself, flicked through his contacts, and dialed.
"Ah, if it isn't the Wolf of Wall Street,"
she began. "Jerry, please, let me explain."
"No need, sweetheart. Let Mama G get you out of this one. It looks bad at the moment, but I promise you I'll have it sorted by the morning. We'll talk tomorrow."
"Really?" asked Stuart, surprised by her relaxed tone.
"Really, trust me. Now go and get some sleep."
Stuart hung up, turned his phone off, and slumped into a large leather armchair. While grateful to her for whatever she had planned, Stuart wondered what Jerry would expect as payback for digging him out of his hole. Chapter 24. Today. Day 11. Nicole had, at best, just a 20-minute window of opportunity to find Tommy. Hours earlier, and with Eric filling the truck with petrol, she'd called ahead to the Venice Beach International Hostel and booked 2 beds in a dormitory room, as she didn't want to be alone in a private room with him. On their return to Venice, she and a reluctant Eric checked in, and on seeing Sadie covering the reception desk, Nicole momentarily feared that in her 4-day absence, Tommy too had ventured forth on the next leg of his travels. More than 7 continuous weeks together meant Nicole knew Eric's habits and routines, and she counted on him taking his regimented 25 minutes to shower, groom, and freshen up. Once he'd announced he was getting out of his sweaty clothes and the shower began running, Nicole flew out of the starting blocks. She sprinted to Tommy's room and found it empty, but was relieved when a quick scan revealed his sleeping bag and backpack were still by his bed. She considered writing him a note, then decided it'd be easier explaining to him in person what she'd learned about Eric. She checked her watch, then ran to the lounge and half-heartedly smiled at a few familiar faces as she scanned the room for Tommy. The kitchen and courtyard were also Tommy-less, and out of frustration she smacked the wall with the palm of her hand. Now she had 10 minutes to run to the hot dog stand, tell Tommy she needed to urgently speak to him, and get back to her room before Eric was any the wiser. En route, she asked herself whether telling Tommy about Maria's note was the wisest thing to do. Eric was correct when he'd suggested she wasn't the best judge of character, and it annoyed her now to think he was probably enjoying a smug laugh at her expense when he'd said it. But she was honest enough to admit to herself her track record was poor. So could she really trust a boy she'd known for a handful of days, or was she setting herself up for more trouble? Unfortunately, she was running out of options. Nicole's run slowed to a walk when she arrived at the hot dog stand to find the help she urgently needed wasn't working there that day. "Fuck it, where are you, Tommy?" she thought, and reluctantly retraced her steps back to the hostel and back to her room.
"Why are you panting?"
asked Eric when he stepped out of the bathroom less than a minute after Nicole returned.
"I was doing a bit of exercise,"
she lied, and flashed him graphics on her phone from a fitness app.
"Too little too late," Eric replied, rolling his eyes. "I think the horse has well and truly bolted through that stable door."
Chapter 25. For 3 days, Ruth survived on chocolate bars, potato chips, 7-Up, and very little sleep.
but it was hope and conviction that spurred her on in her vigil outside Zack Stanley's home, even if to date it had only resulted in 2 meetings with him, neither of which had gone as she'd envisaged. Ruth anxiously looked at her watch and realized it had been 37 hours and 20 minutes since Zack had left his home, and she was desperate to know where he was. There was no battery power left in her phone, so she was unable to go online to see if his whereabouts had been reported on social media. She'd bought a USA Today on her last journey to the store at the foot of the hills, but nothing had been reported about Zack either in the news section or its life supplement. She paced in a circular motion like a caged bear in a zoo. She nibbled the skin around her dirty fingernails and fretted about his safety. What if he'd been involved in a car accident? Or if he'd taken ill and was poorly in hospital? How would his friends and family know how to get in touch with his biggest fan to tell her what had happened? Every hour she pressed the intercom buzzer or waved her arms at the security camera to get attention from Zack's staff. But no one responded. The more Ruth tried to reassure herself that Zack was okay, the more dominant the irrational side of her brain became, warning her something terrible must have happened to him. And as sleep deprivation and hunger took its toll, Ruth's emotions switched from anger to frustration, concern, and then distress, and she promised herself she would remain exactly where she was, no matter how long it took. Chapter 26. The stains on the threadbare lounge carpet were the only things holding it together, thought Tommy as he vacuumed the remnants of the previous night's party. The vacuum cleaner dated back at least 2 decades, and was so noisy and vibrated so intensely, he wondered if he should be wearing earmuffs like a pneumatic drill operator. Sprawled across a sofa, Jake kept him company, skimming through a book on Eastern philosophy he'd plucked from the hostel's library shelf. But he was finding it hard to focus on its teachings in the presence of a shirtless Tommy, stretching backwards and forwards, cleaning the carpets. Jake already knew how Tommy's mouth tasted. But now he wondered what his body would feel like, wrapped against his own, or how his warm breath might feel on his neck.
Stop it!
Jake suddenly interrupted his daydreams and moved his head from side to side as if to dislodge the inappropriate thoughts. He told himself he'd only been thinking about his friend in that way, because he hadn't been intimate with another person in almost a year.
It's lust you're feeling. Nothing more, nothing less, he told himself, and placed the book on his lap to disguise his growing arousal.
He noticed Tommy scowl as Matty and Declan walked past the lounge carrying footballs under their arms.
Ladies, nodded Declan, slowing his pace. You know, it really warms our hearts to see a bit of a man-on-man romance. That touching photo of you guys is the talk of the building.
Oh, fuck off,
replied Tommy, and took a swig from a bottle of Pepsi. Matty turned to Declan.
I'd have expected a bit more gratitude for capturing such a tender moment on camera.
I should have known it was you idiots,
said Tommy, to which Matty and Declan grinned and waved before continuing their journey. Tommy opened his mouth to shout to them, but Jake spoke first.
Don't bother replying. They're not worth it, he said.
They're going to regret it.
Why? What's the point? They've had their fun. Just let it lie.
They've humiliated me.
So you're saying people thinking you're gay is humiliating?
No, that's not... No, I meant...
Then leave it.
With the carpets as clean as Tommy could manage without the aid of paraffin and a match, he took a dustpan and brush and began working his way through the first of 6 sofas, removing the cushion seats and scooping out stray nickels and dimes that had fallen from pockets into the creases. Tommy was fumbling around to pull out confectionery wrappers when his fingertips touched something leathery. He removed a brown tan wallet and looked inside. There were only a few dollar bills, 3 McDonald's vouchers, and an old debit card with the name Matthew O'Keefe embossed on the front next to a driver's license. He briefly considered doing the right thing, but his dislike for Matty and Declan was so intense that he changed his mind and walked towards the plastic bag of rubbish Paik had cleared earlier. He was ready to take the cash and toss the wallet away when he noticed a newspaper cutting protruding from the bills. Curious, he took it out and raised his eyebrows when he read it.
"Nail meat coffin,"
he said out loud and punched the air. Chapter 27
"Jim Morrison was my first crush when I was a girl,"
smiled Jane, pointing towards artist Rip Kronk's 20-foot-high mural of a shirtless Doors frontman emblazoned upon a wall.
"I must have only been 6 or 7 when I saw him in one of my sister's music magazines, and he made me weak at the knees,"
Jane continued. Savannah lifted her head to look at the painting, and although she couldn't name even one of the Doors' songs, she recognized the band's name from what her father called The Forbidden List, a 4-page document of musicians and groups that, if listened to, would be tantamount to allowing Satan directly into your heart.
"One of the reasons I came to Venice Beach was to see this mural, and where Jim moved to when he and Ray finished university and formed the group."
Savannah struggled to match Jane's enthusiasm on the subject, but she was coming to enjoy the company of her new roommate. Jane took a photograph of the mural on an archaic pre-internet mobile phone before they made their way a couple of blocks back towards the boardwalk. Savannah linked arms with Jane. It had been a long time since she'd felt so comfortable with a virtual stranger, and the more time they spent together, the more she felt her guard slipping. Frequently they paused to watch the street performers, and now a peculiar duo caught their attention. They consisted of an elderly, wrinkled white woman in a pink spiky wig, yellow plastic sunglasses and a bikini, and a very tall black man, wearing just leopard-skin swimming trunks and a sombrero. He tunelessly plucked at 3 strings on a banjo, while she banged a tambourine and hopped on 1 foot.
"Do you think they're a couple?"
asked Savannah.
"I'm not even sure they're human,"
joked Jane.
"But I love that they found each other. Like-minded souls can find each other in the most unusual of circumstances."
Neither Savannah nor Jane recognized the song the clueless entertainers were attempting to play, or understood the point of their act, but they admired their tenacity and dropped some loose change in their collection box.
"You mentioned your sister last night. Rosanna, was it?"
Jane asked. Savannah nodded.
"I miss her. We were pretty close. It's funny you bring her up, 'cause she turned 16 today.
You could always call her, you know, just to wish her a happy birthday and let her know you're okay."
"I've thought about it, but I'm scared of what my dad would do to her if he found out."
"He can't be that bad, can he?"
"You have no idea what he's capable of, Jane,"
Savannah replied. And a flashback of a mallet striking Michael's hands and forehead made her shiver.
6 months is a long time. You don't know if the situation at home has changed since you left."
Savannah was convinced it hadn't, and the tremendous guilt she'd felt for leaving her sister behind to fend for herself suddenly returned. Chapter 28
"I can't find it,"
said Matty anxiously, the contents of his backpack strewn across the floor of their room.
"It's got to be somewhere,"
replied Declan, stripping both beds of sheets and pillowcases and looking under mattresses.
"Yeah, big help. Everything's somewhere."
"Calm your jets, man. It's only got the money we made from pawning your necklace."
"It's got the newspaper story inside as well."
Declan stopped what he was doing and turned to face Matty.
"What?"
he said slowly.
"That's why you're so jittery."
"I thought you knew."
"No, I didn't feckin' know, you idiot."
I know, you don't have to say it."
"But I'm going to, because I told you to get rid of... If anyone here reads that, we're shafted."
1 year earlier, Dublin Airport. Matty and Declan's box-fresh rucksacks disappeared along the conveyor belt as they left the Lufthansa check-in desk and walked back towards Matty's parents.
"You've got everything. Your passports, your boarding cards, your wallets,"
fussed Matty's mother.
You have that bag, don't you? Make sure you have that bag. Yes, I have it. Now don't worry, I've been abroad before.
Matty reassured his mother, but it failed to placate her, and she promptly burst into tears. Matty's father offered her a hug.
Don't worry, Mummy. You've known all along I have to leave on my own terms.
I know, said Mrs. O'Keefe. But you're still our little boy, and we're going to miss you so much.
Let him be, Deirdre, interrupted her husband. He knows what he's doing. Take care of yourself, son.
His teary-eyed parents hugged Matty, then Declan, and the boys began to walk towards the departure lounge. Suddenly Matty turned towards them.
You did a good job, you know, with me. You did a good job. Thank you.
Matty didn't wait for their reaction or a reply as his own tears began to roll down his cheeks and land on the lapels of his jacket. Instead, he turned around and continued to walk as Declan placed a supporting arm around his friend's shoulder. It's not too late to change your mind, he said. Matty shook his head.
Not a chance.
The air conditioning blew cold and noisily above the drone of the engines as the plane taxied down the runway towards its takeoff slot. Declan stared through his window at the country he was consigning to his past, at least for the foreseeable future. There was little about it he would miss. Certainly not the parents who'd brought him into that world. His mother'd moved to Shannon 3 years earlier, and Declan had lost count of the number of times she'd texted him her new pay-as-you-go phone numbers. She had stuck to her word and attempted to stay in touch with her sons, but Declan wasn't prepared to listen to her apologies for putting alcohol above her family's needs. Then, when he'd finally decided to grasp her olive branch, her number no longer existed. Declan and his father navigated their home in different directions and at different times of the day. His dad was a nocturnal man, preferring to drink by night and sleep by day. So Declan accepted the mantle of role model to Finn and Michael, his two younger brothers, and in doing so often became the barrier between them and their father's drunken fists. Hours after saying goodbye to them, he was already feeling immense guilt for leaving them behind. But he took comfort that they were now both working at the warehouse depot. And from his ill-gotten post office gains, he'd paid the deposit and 3 months' rent money for their new flat over the Curry House and away from their father. The rest of their booty, he and Matty planned to use for their own hedonistic gratification. By the end of that day, there'd be sand between their toes, as they watched the sunset at Ibiza's legendary Café del Mar before hitting the clubs. Then Spain, Italy, France, Germany, Sweden, Thailand, South America and North America would follow, God willing. After that, well, who knew, as they would most likely be living on borrowed time. Yes, Declan thought, there was much to be excited about once their plane rose above the asphalt. But there was an equal amount to feel uneasy over, too. Sometimes he wondered if uneasy was a feeling he would ever shake off.
Oh, fuck.
Matty interrupted Declan's thoughts.
Oh, fuck,
he repeated. What's wrong?
Look.
Matty passed him a copy of the Irish Times he'd picked up at W.H. Smith's in the airport. Declan recognized a familiar face in a picture the size of a postage stamp. Postmaster dies after bungled armed robbery, read the headline. What the? Gasped Declan, and continued to read. A man died yesterday following an armed robbery at his post office a week ago. John Wallace, 68, who ran Navan's only post office for 36 years, collapsed with a suspected heart attack as two robbers attacked his premises. A Garda spokesman said, "We believe they might have been captured on CCTV outside a nearby newsagent's. If that is the case, we hope to quickly identify them before they strike again."
"Dec, we killed him,"
said Matty quietly. And Declan closed the newspaper.
"We killed someone."
Declan remained silent, stared at the seat in front of him and gripped the armrest. After a minute or so, he spoke. "It was an accident, Matty. It had a weak ticker. Could have happened at any time to anyone. We have to forget about him." Matty stared at Declan and didn't reply.
Mattia said we had to forget about him, okay? Mattie nodded reluctantly, and Declan put his headphones on, chose a Ministry of Sound playlist, and pumped up the volume to drown out his own uneasiness. He didn't hear Mattie tear the story out of the paper, fold it neatly, and place it in his wallet. Today. By the time their room had been searched from top to bottom, it resembled a Midwestern state trailer park after a tornado. Declan stood in the center of the room, rubbing his eyes and pinching the bridge of his nose in disbelief. I cannot believe you'd be that stupid. When did you have your wallet last? Mattie closed his eyes and retraced his steps from the night before.
The lounge, he suddenly blurted out. When we got back from the beach, I stopped off to buy some gum and came straight back in here for the party.
Then let's go find it. But as they opened their bedroom door, Tommy was standing on the other side with the missing article in his hand.
Looking for this?
He smiled. Chapter 29. Despite Ruth's promise to herself that she wouldn't fall asleep again until she was sure Zack was safe and sound, it took the horn of his SUV to wake her up from an unplanned siesta. Zack glared at her from behind the wheel of his vehicle as the gates to his property opened, and he screeched to a halt. Ruth's initial relief that he was still alive gave way to fear when Zack leapt from the vehicle and charged towards her, chest puffed out and nostrils flared.
"Why are you still here, bitch?"
he yelled, not giving her a chance to respond.
"This is your last chance to get the fuck off my street."
Ruth swallowed hard, terrified of Zack's aggression. And when she was too scared and confused to reply, he pulled out his phone and began to dial a number before walking back towards his house. Suddenly she burst into life.
"No, please don't go, Zack. I just want to talk to you,"
Ruth pleaded.
"I've seen all your films and interviews, and you seem like such a good guy."
"I'm an actor. I get paid to be nice, and you ain't paid me shit.
I'd like to report an intruder who's harassing me. Yeah, it's Zack Stanley. I'm on Sunset Plaza Drive. Yeah, as soon as possible, thank you."
"But I know you love animals, and so do I. I nursed a sick dog, but he, died."
Ruth added desperately.
"What are you talking about?"
replied Zack, genuinely baffled.
"We could be friends. I know we could."
"Us? You and me?" "You turn up at my house uninvited, and you think we're going to be buddies? Life doesn't work like that."
"But it can. Look at that film you were in, Baby Baby, the bit where you say, 'I know this is the first time we've met, but I don't ever want to lose sight of you again.' That's how I feel about you."
"It's just a fucking film. And that's the trouble with people like you. You can't see the difference between what's on a screen and what's real life. So you come to my home and harass me and think we'll be besties. Fool.
Please, Zack, please. I know you like me if you give me a chance. I'm a good person. I really am."
"Look at you. You're... shit, I don't even know what you are. What's with your clothes? You stink of B.O. I can smell your breath from here. And that hair, have you ever washed it? I've dated Miley, Ariana, Iggy... Tell me, how would I explain you to my friends?"
Ruth paused for a moment.
"We don't have to tell anyone. We could be secret friends."
Zack paused to take stock of the latest in a long line of obsessive fans. But none had been as pitiable as Ruth. In his mind, he'd tried diplomacy. He'd attempted to be polite, and he'd used the cruel-to-be-kind approach, but nothing had worked. So when Ruth grabbed his arm, there was only one option left open to him. He swung around sharply and grabbed Ruth by the throat, pushing his face into hers.
"Listen, bitch, for the last time, I ain't interested in you or being your pal," he hissed. "Now get your stupid fat ass out of here before I do something you're gonna regret."
Then he shoved Ruth to the pavement and removed his wallet from his pocket.
"If I was poor, you wouldn't want me, would you? For people like you, it's all about getting a piece of my fame and my money."
He threw a handful of $50 and $100 bills at Ruth. And she wept as the money and her dreams landed in the gutter.
"There, you don't need anything from me now, right?"
The last time Ruth had heard those words, they'd come from her father's lips. She promised herself she would never hear them again from someone she loved, and that included Zack. Zack turned his head when he noticed Ruth's shadow against his gatepost. But before he could react,